Our God reigns. We're counting on that one. Especially appropriate for the passage we're going to be looking at today in Esther 3. If you're just joining us, we're in a verse-by-verse study going through the story of Esther. It's in your Old Testament, page 345, if you have one of the church Bibles. While you're turning there, I want to just point out something. If you're new to Sunridge, quarterly we do a class. It's called Sunridge 101. It happens right after our second service at 11:45 in room 107 out there. We'd love to have you. If you got kids, we got childcare, we got food. Consider it a date. You know, if you're new to Sunridge, take your significant other to this date, and you just get to learn about Sunridge. So, anyway, it'd be really exciting, riveting. And I'm sure you'll enjoy it. What's the worst news you ever got? You don't have to shout it out. I know you're a rowdy crowd today. I mean, maybe some of you have heard, you know, you get a letter that says you're being sued. Or maybe someone that you love and you've slept with for years says, I want a divorce. Maybe one of your children was arrested. Sometimes the worst news you can get is that they're out of smoked butterscotch lattes at Starbucks. I know, it's like devastating. But some things just happen. There's bad news and then there's extra bad news. Isn't that a way to start off an uplifting sermon? Everybody gets bad news. And I want to point you to Esther 3, the end of the chapter in verse 15. It says, the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa was bewildered. Read uproar. Read anxious. What's the story there? What's going on? If I could just back up to the beginning, we're in this story about Esther. And you know that at this time, the Hebrew people, they are in captivity to Persia. And so they answer to this king, Xerxes. And Xerxes, as Jed unpacked last week, took the kingdom and people and humanity backwards in some of his power-hungry ways. And so in the middle of that, in his self-serving interest, he fires Queen Vashti. And then through his advisors, he gets another idea. Let's replace the queen. So they do a search throughout the kingdom to find the perfect young virgin for the king. And this woman that the story is about, Esther, emerges. She is beautiful, she's wise, and she's got guts. And that's the underline to this story about Esther. And so she comes on the scene and she wins the heart of the king. She wins the heart of the people around her. There's not a lot of explanation for that, but she does so. She seems to be very winsome. And she's connected to a man who came, you know, into our arena of the story named Mordecai. He's her cousin, probably an older cousin, because he adopts her. She's evidently an orphan and he brings her in. So he has this connection, and he's, in some way, he is like one of the king's officials, and it also appears that he's kind of respected as a Jewish leader, even though they're a conquered people. He sits at the gate of the city, which is where people of honor would be to answer questions. We don't really know exactly what he was doing there, but he has this position of prominence, and yet he's Jewish. Esther's Jewish. King Xerxes doesn't really realize this. And Mordecai, in chapter 2, he uncovers this plot to assassinate King Xerxes. And so he saves the king's life. But somehow I find ourselves like in verse 15 of this chapter. So I want to go all the way back to the start of chapter 3 and kind of catch up to the story. And it says that after these events, that is the firing of Queen Vashti, the discovery of Esther, the attempted assassination of Xerxes. After these events, King Xerxes honored Haman. Now, here's another name for you. It's like it's becoming like a Russian novel. I know. You have to go back and look at all the names. But Haman is the son of Hammedatha, the Agag. And so, remember that. No, actually, remember that. I know. Elevating him and giving him a seat of honor higher than that of the other nobles. So somehow Haman gets promoted. There's not a lot of explanation of why Xerxes sees promise in him, but he promotes him higher than any other nobles. And in verse 2, all the royal officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid honor to Haman, which is what you're supposed to do. Anybody of prominence, when they go by, they bow. And for the king had commanded this. There's even a rule out about this concerning him. But Mordecai, remember Esther's cousin, would not kneel down or pay him honor. And it doesn't say why. Maybe he just didn't like him. Maybe he was pompous, which that might be a clue. But every day that he goes by and Mordecai doesn't bow down, people notice. And so they start to ask Mordecai, what's up? Why aren't you bowing down? The king said to do this. And day after day, they hit him up about it. He doesn't seem to answer, but he doesn't comply either. And so they take this information back to Haman because they wanted to see if there were going to be different rules for someone who is Jewish. So they all know his heritage. And in verse 5, when Haman saw that Mordecai would not kneel down, maybe he never noticed this before, but because people put it on his radar, now it's bugging him. And so as he walks by Mordecai, Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor. And so he was enraged. Do you get the feeling like maybe this culture has an anger issue as we've gone through the story? In verse 6, yet having learned who Mordecai's people were, he scorned the idea of only killing Mordecai. There's something deeper here. I don't just want to take out this guy that isn't giving me the honor that I think I'm due. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all of Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes. Now I want to go back to that connection of Haman's heritage, because he's an Amalekite. And there's this story in the Old Testament about a time when the prophet Samuel comes upon this king, Agag, and he hacks him to death. Sorry about that. That was like PG-13. The prophet, enraged about things, kills this king. This is over 500 years later that we find Haman and Mordecai interacting. But the feud has come through those centuries because Samuel is Jewish and Haman comes from Agag. And so you have these two peoples that even though they're living in this kingdom together, there's still this underlying thing. And it goes so deep for Haman that he doesn't just want to murder Haman. He wants to annihilate all of his people. Maybe Mordecai has the same feelings toward Haman, and that's why he won't bow down. That's speculation. Verse 7, in the 12th year of Xerxes, in the first month, the month of Nisan, they, that is Haman and his circle, cast the poor, that is the lot. Now, we're going to talk about this eventually in the series, but the poor, it's like dice. And so this is how they would make decisions. It's like the original eight ball. Does she like me? Try again. How many of you that are under 30 know what an eight ball is? Okay, thank you. In the presence of Haman, they cast this lot, and in the presence of Haman, to select a day and a month. That's when this thing is going to happen, when we're going to annihilate the Jewish people. And the lot fell on the 12th month, the month of Adar. This casting of the poor is why the Jewish people celebrate Purim. And we'll talk about that near the end. But if you put this timeline together, the Jewish people have 11 months to live. They have a terminal illness in their ethnicity. And Haman takes his plan to Xerxes, the king. He's got to get his stamp of approval. And he uses the age-old method of manipulating him and feeding him only the information that he thinks is going to move Xerxes in his direction. He combines fear. He says, these people are different. They should not be tolerated. They're disobeying your laws. There's a self-interest in this. It's like you have every reason not to like these people, just as I do, and a bribe. Kind of sounds like American politics, but I'll leave that alone. Okay. So who could say no to self-interest, you know, fear and hate and a bribe? Works. And in verse 11, keep the money, the king said to Haman, which is disingenuous, most scholars feel, because he needed the money to wage his wars. And then this last little phrase, do with the people as you please. It's kind of like ultimate dismissal, an entire group of peoples. I wash my hands of this matter, do whatever you want. Which says something about the isolation of power and wealth, what it can do to you. Now we're almost back to where we started. And in verse 13, what happens is dispatches were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with the order to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews. Do you see the three words jump out? Destroy, kill, annihilate. This is like the original Holocaust. And not just men, like in war. The decree says to annihilate the young and the old, the women and little children, all on a single day, and it's on the calendar. On the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, and when you do so, you can plunder their goods. You can have everything that they have. It's even worse than what we just read, because the timing of this lands the Jewish people scattered throughout the region, they would hear this word the day before Passover, the morning of. So this celebration that they have in their history is part of their tradition. To celebrate God's deliverance on that day, the news will arrive to them that says, 11 months from now, you're going to die. And there's nothing you can do about it. And in the middle of all that, in verse 15, the king and Haman sat down to drink. That's the story. This entire story rolls forward to land in these people's laps who've done nothing. And they have this date in their mind. There's this terrible, awful thing out in their future. Now, there's a lot to talk about with this. When I look at chapter 3, I think we could talk about anger issues. It's a no-brainer. We could talk about, again, alcohol abuse. We could talk about what bitterness will do to you. Because Haman, he's so filled with this hatred, this irrational hate, that he wants to take out an entire group of people. We could talk about how easily people are manipulated, especially people like Xerxes, who have a thirst for power and for people to tell them what they want to hear. And just a little short word, and he dismisses an entire group of people. But today, I want to talk about two things. And I got to tell you, like, I want to give credit to my slide people, to my guide, the note guide that I put out, because I totally changed this up last night. So if you've already printed the note sheet, go in again, because I changed it, because I added this part. I want to talk about two things. I want to talk about worry today and anxiety, because this is an obvious response. The whole city's in an uproar. But I also want to talk about Mordecai's refusal to bow. This is like civil disobedience 101. In verse 2, you just to recall it, it's like all the royal officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid honor to Haman, but for the king had commanded this concerning him, but Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor. And you know what? It's like the story, it doesn't tell how he does it. Did he stand up in defiance? and eyeball Haman as he went by? Did he just humbly bow and, I mean, like look down but not kneel in his presence? It doesn't say, but it's like there's something in him that says, I'm not doing that. And, you know, probably he bowed for the king. But somehow he gets on the radar for not bowing to Haman. And it got me thinking, like, how do you know when to do that? How do you know when to take your stand like that and say, I'm not going to be pushed over that line? It's an important question. Because I think the Bible kind of like gives us these two extremes, at least the way we kind of process it. We think, of course, you should obey the authority and those people that rule over us. And then yet, like, there's these instances where people stand up and they say no. So how do you figure that all out? I want to just touch on that today. And I can't cover every little detail of this, but I do want to, like, zero in on a process that I think that people have helped me with, and I want to share that with you. You know, certainly we see Jesus following the customs and rules, and then we see him rejecting them, the Apostle Paul. And then I love these two extremes of the Apostle Peter, who tended to be a little extreme at times. In his own book, his epistle that he writes in 1 Peter 2:13, he says, submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every authority instituted among men. So there's like this overlay of like those people who name the name of Christ. We should follow authority. Yet, in Acts 4, verse 19, he and John are being told to stop preaching the gospel, and they reply, judge for yourselves whether it's right in God's sight to obey you rather than God, for we cannot help speaking about what we've seen and heard. You see the two? Like, which is it? So I want to offer some really practical advice on this idea of how to figure it out. And it's not original with me. It really comes from Rick Warren and some version of that. But the first thing I want to say is, like, if you're trying to figure out, is this a point of standing or is this a point of following authority? I would say, you know, try to categorize the issue. And by categorize the issue, I'd say put it in one of three categories. Is it a preference? Is it a belief? Or is it a conviction? Try to think of your issue in putting it in one of those categories. A preference has no biblical basis. It is something that is personal for you. It could be like, I think the walls at church should be painted gray or they should be millet. I don't know. You could say, I like my music loud. I like my music soft. I like hymns. I like, the latest, you know, punk music or whatever. See, that's a preference. The Bible doesn't talk about any of that. So there's a whole list of preferences that we have. And then there's another category, though, of beliefs, that we can find them in the Bible, or at least we believe we can, right? And so we find some verses that support that. And it's like, that's a belief. But we understand with a belief that there's my belief, and then there's all these respected people that have a different position on that belief. You tracking with me? Shake your head. And then there's conviction. And a conviction is a thing that can't move. It's usually a belief that has somehow become cemented in you, usually because of an experience or because of something that's happened in your life. And you say, you know, the next time I'm there, I am doing this. And it's like, it's something that's deep within you. Categorize your issue and ask yourself, is it a preference? Is it a belief that we can give and take on? Or is it a deep conviction that I can't bend on? And then once you've done that, determine the appropriate response for that. And I'd give you four responses. One is, I would die for this issue. Think of it in concentric circles, like a target. And the bullseye in the very center is, this is stuff I would die for. Or I'd like to think I would die for it. Like the gospel. But there's a slightly bigger circle around that. You would say, I wouldn't die for it, but I would break relationships over it. You getting me? It's like, it's not an issue that I'd lay down my life for, but I can't hang out, I can't align myself to because of this issue. And then there's a bigger circle around that. It's like, I wouldn't die for it, and I wouldn't break relationship for it, but I would argue about it. I'm willing to debate you on it. And I'll vigorously, a robust dialogue I would have with you over this issue. And then the last circle, which is probably the biggest circle, is I wouldn't argue over it, I wouldn't die for it, and I wouldn't break fellowship over it. Usually preferences. So categorize that issue and determine where it fits in your response. That's important. It's important because human nature tries to press more and more into the center two circles. And we try to make our issues out here become, I can't fellowship with you because you like rock and roll music. Literally. And so so what happens to us is we start fussing over things that are peripheral issues. But there are some things to take a stand for. And Mordecai does so. The key here is to keep the bullseye small. To not keep moving our preferences or our debatable beliefs toward the center of things that everything can't be of utmost importance. I know that I might be saying the obvious, but if we don't hold that well in our church, in our relationships, in our marriage, we start to blow things up out of proportion. Or on the other end of the spectrum, we accept things that we should never accept. You guys still with me?
Yes.
Okay. I think Mordecai had a process. I don't think it was Rick Warren's because it wouldn't fit the timeline. But I see him, as you go through this book, I see him thoughtfully approaching his conflicts that he has. And not just irrationally standing up and wanting to fight about everything, but I see him having some core beliefs that he says, that's my line and I can't cross it. And I think that we should absorb both of those fully. I think it's especially important in this time because I think we as Christians, we tend to be all over the map on stuff. And we're fighting about these things and then accepting all of this. Do you remember Jesus said to the Pharisees, you strain at a gnat and you swallow a camel? We have to be able to think thoughtfully about those issues that are very important to us, whether it be in our church, in our organization, on our team, in my marriage. We got to think rationally about these things and put the emphasis on the right syllable, right? Okay, second thing, I want to talk about worry because there's legitimate worry here. I'm not even going to deal with illegitimate worry. I mean, if you're a worry wart, so am I. I'll tell you what, I own the 2 to 4 a.m. worry period. If you want to take midnight to 2 or 4 to 6, I need help on that. But 2 to 4, that's mine. So you don't have to worry. I'll be worrying for you during that time. Mordecai and Esther have a good deal to worry about. The city of Susa was bewildered. And you remember what has led up to this. And in chapter 4, verse 1, Mordecai, when he learns of all that had been done, he tears his clothes, puts on sackcloth and ashes, and went out into the city wailing loudly and bitterly. This is devastating news. I don't mean to make light of it. We can't even, like, inject ourselves into that story at the ultimate and most accurate level. This is devastating news. There's two things that really cause worry. One is an increased sense of vulnerability. We feel like we're exposed in some way, and someone could hurt us or something, a heightened sense of vulnerability, and a diminished sense of power. I have all of these concerns, these things that could happen to me, and then I have no power in it. That is the situation Mordecai and estrogen. And when you bring those two together, that's like a toxic combination, isn't it? I'm vulnerable and I have no power. That's where they're living. And we have different ways of dealing with that. So some of us are deniers, right? We're like Scarlett O'Hara. I'll worry about that tomorrow, for tomorrow's another day. Is that disturbing? I can quote Gone with the Wind, guys. If you're a denier, raise your hand. Come on, this is group confession. It's good for the soul. No deniers out there? Okay, good. Okay. Then there's some of us, we're fix-its, right? As soon as we worry about something, we get to work on a plan. We go into fix-it mode. How many of you are fixers? Okay. And if denial doesn't work and fix-it doesn't work, then we usually medicate, and I won't ask you to raise your hands on that. I'm not saying they're wrong for worrying. I think that they're probably right. There's stuff that you legitimately should worry about. And I'm not saying that worry is always wrong, because Jesus even said that every day has enough to worry about. Is that true? Can you say amen to that? You'll wake up tomorrow. You think you're worrying today. You'll get all that figured out. You get all your problems solved. And then tomorrow you'll wake up and there'll be a whole new list of problems. I want to talk about how to respond to worry. And again, I'm borrowing from somebody else, a guy that I listen to. I listen to many podcasts. One of them is Pete Wilson, and he made this statement that just like hit me a couple of months ago. I was mountain biking. I stopped. I read it into my phone and sent it to myself as an email so I wouldn't forget it. And he said this: stop trying to control what you can't control. Stop trying to control what you cannot control. Stephen Covey, in his book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, he talks about our circle of concern and our circle of influence. Our circle of influence is this big, and our circle of concern is this big. And the more we focus on the circle of concern, our circle of influence shrinks. As long as we're worrying about all the stuff that we can't control, the stuff that we can do something about, we're missing. The psalmist said it this way: be still and know that I am God. Be still, more directly translated, is cease striving. Cease striving. It's not be lazy. It's not just have no disregard for an issue. It's like stop fighting and know that I'm God. Because the one thing I know, if you're striving, you forget who God is. Stop trying to control what you cannot control, and connected to that is move toward God, not away from Him. Because I think most of us do just the opposite. When we receive news that's worrisome, bad news on a bad day, the worst kind of news you can get, it is your circus and your monkeys today, that tends to push many of us away from God. So in this Psalm 46, where the psalmist says, be still and know that I am God, it begins this way: God is our refuge and our shield, an ever-present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, though the earth give way and the mountains fall into the heart of the sea, though its waters roar and foam and the mountains quake with their surging. God is our refuge. There are things that I cannot control that I have to release to God and allow that thing to draw me toward Him, not to push me away. Let me give you a visual of this. You got your hands? Put your hands out. And your hands are representative of how we handle worry with God, right? When you're worried, there's a couple things you can do, right? You can ball up your fists and you can fight, right? Do that with me. Punch your neighbor. No. Yeah. Oh, some of you have got a lot of aggression. You belong in Persia around this time. Okay, you can grab, right? Reach out and grab, like clench it. You can hold on to something. You can do this, right? You can push it away. But try this. Put your hands down at your side and just relax. This is what it means to be still and know that He is God. Because remember, like, this situation is beyond you. You're vulnerable and you're powerless and you can't fight. You're wasting your effort. You can't grab. You can't push away. The best thing you could do is release it. You're not trusting in the outcome. You're trusting in the person who has control of the outcome. Be still and know that I am God. Let me read you another psalm. Psalm 55:22, cast your cares on the Lord and He will sustain you. If this week, last week, 6 months ago, 3 years ago, you got news that said your circus and your monkeys were coming to town, cast your cares on the Lord, for He will sustain you. Jesus said the same thing. And he didn't want us to push away at this time. He invited us in when He said, come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. He said, trust me and invite me in. Come to me. I want to close with this story about a man named Horatio Spafford. You know this name? He wrote the hymn, It Is Well. Horatio Spafford was born in the early 1800s, and he became a wealthy lawyer in the city of Chicago. So wealthy that he translated all of that wealth into tons of property. In his heyday, at his pinnacle, he owned tons of properties, super wealthy, he has 5 children, he has a charmed life. And then his son dies. He has 5 kids, a son and 4 daughters, and his son dies. And then 2 years later, the Great Chicago Fire happens, and he loses almost all of his properties. And because of all the tension and everything he had to deal with, he decides to pack up his 4 daughters and his wife and send them for a little retreat to England. And they get on a ship, and en route to England, their ship collides with another ship, and all 4 daughters die. Only his wife survives. And he gets news of this from her in a letter back to him. And it's then that Spafford decides to reconnect with his wife, and he gets on a ship himself. And in the spot where the 2 ships collide, he writes a memorial, It Is Well. The words are, when peace like a river attends my way, when sorrows like sea billows roll. Do you see the picture here? When life is good, he sits by a river and the stream is calming. And yet, on this ship, on the way to his wife, he can envision the rough seas. He says, in either one, it is well. It's well with my soul. Spafford and his wife go on to migrate to Jerusalem, and they launch a ministry called the American Colony. It's a charitable institution that ministers to Muslims and Christians and unbelievers. And that ministry becomes critical during World War I for all the orphans it creates, and, you know, people that are devastated and homeless. And they spend a lifetime ministering to people. And I say, I don't know how the guy did it. The only way he could do it is that he stopped trying to control what he couldn't control. And he let those deep sorrows draw him toward his Lord, not away. Will you pray with me? God, this story is real. It feels real. Even though I can't imagine getting word that my life is going to be taken in 11 months, I can't imagine really bad news. I don't even have to imagine. I've had seasons like that, and most people sitting in this auditorium have. Would you help us? One, help us to know how to divide and distinguish between the issues that arise and know when to stand and when to compromise. And secondly, help us to turn towards you in those times of trouble, to turn toward the cross, to accept the invitation of Jesus when he says, come to us, come to me. In Jesus' name, amen.